Whether you're writing or speaking or whatever you're doing, it's important that you know who your audience is. And it's very difficult to know who an audience is in a time like this. But I try to get an understanding of who you might be, because I don't want to waste your time. And I don't want to waste my time either. I'm not here as an entertainer. I'm here, and I seriously take this responsibility. I'm here as some sort of a spokesman to men who belong to the family of God. And that's important. And so what is there to say? When Phil asked me, you know, what do you think you should talk about? What should your title be? And I just said off the top of my head, well, how about lessons from life? Things that I have learned. And so we agreed upon that I should try and give you some things that I have learned from my life. A pretty ordinary life in many ways, but there are a lot of lessons to be learned, and things that we learn that we can put aside and forget, or things that we can learn and build into our being that make us different and help us to grow and help us to develop. Because I would then say, well, fancy this crazy crowd at St. Elf's asking a guy to come and speak to them on one of their important meetings who's 83 years old, for heaven's sake. Anyone else? Anybody older than I am? I'm just about to turn 84. Nobody. Oh, yes, there is one.
94.
Well, why aren't you up here speaking and not me? Because in 94 years, there are lessons to be learned. I was just an ordinary kid. I grew up in Sydney, Australia. I was smart. I went to what they called an opportunity class when I was in primary school, which was supposedly for high IQ kids. I went to high school, and that was the end of my smartness. I didn't do well at high school. I left school at 14 years of age with what we called in those days an intermediate certificate, which allowed me to work. But I was so tired of the whole business of education. And I could say to you who may have been teachers, and this is probably more about me, but I cannot recall one single teacher in my high school, not one, who took a personal interest in me. And so I wavered and washed my way through. And so any expertise that I might have, anything I have to offer is stuff that I have picked up along the way. I have an honorary doctorate that some crazy university gave to me when I addressed them in terms of leadership, and I have done all sorts of things that would make people surprised if I told them what my educational standard was. But nonetheless, I'm just here as an ordinary guy. But there's a wonderful verse in Psalm 145, and it says this: one generation shall tell to another the works, the wonderful works of God. They will tell of your mighty acts. They will speak of the glorious splendor of your majesty. And so I challenge you guys. One generation shall talk to another. We tend to look at the kids critically, and we see all sorts of things that they wish they would be, but we never open our mouths to say, look, I understand where you are. And I just want to tell you, for any value it might be, where I have traveled and how I've traveled through these things. And so that's one reason for me saying, yes, I'll come along and speak to you, because if it's my opportunity, my joy, my responsibility to tell you of the glorious splendor of the majesty of God that I have learned over my life. And yet when I was a kid, it wasn't like that. I was brought up in the church, something like this, and I felt that my mum and dad and my pastor and God were in a collusion to take away my ambition. Because all I wanted to do was to fly aeroplanes. That's why I left school, because I knew that my mum and dad could never afford to have me taught to fly. And so I left school at 14 and got two jobs and worked my guts out. And by the time I was 18, I had basically a commercial flying license and very little other education. So I was just an ordinary kid. And but this voice behind me asking me to respond somehow to what I was hearing in my church life and what I was hearing under the sound of the preaching that I would get. I used to sit in the back seat of church as far away from my father as I could get with my mates and not take a great interest, but I couldn't stop some sort of compelling influence that there is something in this, but I wanted to fly. That's all there was. And so there was this resistance in my early life to respond in any way to the faith call upon my life. Until one day, not in public, no one else was there in my bedroom, not even my brothers or my mum and dad were even in the house. When I decided, it was a Saturday afternoon, I don't know why it so turned out that was the program of it all, but I decided that the love of God for me, if it was real, was bigger than my ambition to fly. And so I said, yes, I will yield this life and my ambition to you, God. And I think I had my fingers prayerfully crossed behind my back, saying, I hope he doesn't take that ambition away. But looking back on it with hindsight, I felt that he was saying, I gave you that ambition. And watch what I can do with it if you yield that with your life to me. And so my life for the next 37 or 40 years, or more than that, was involved in aviation, but in aviation within the kingdom of God. And I served for 37 years with Mission Aviation Fellowship. And I'm so glad to think that I was able to serve God doing the thing that I was impassioned about as a kid. And I think that is a very special privilege. The other verse that I would bring to you is a verse that I was just mentioning before. It comes from Jeremiah 15, verse 19. And I've found myself over the years speaking at meetings in the United Nations, in the biggest churches in America, all over the world. And I've thought so many times, if only they knew my educational qualifications, they would never have asked me to come here. But in Jeremiah 15, verse 19, the second half of that verse says this: if you utter worthy and not worthless words, you will be my spokesman. And that was the strength behind the role that I had in my latter part of my MAF years, and when I was more in public and speaking at conferences and all over the place, to be a spokesman of God. That's pretty serious stuff. And so I would say to myself as I come to you, be careful what you say, boy. Don't waffle to these guys. Don't uplift yourself. You are nothing. You are a spokesman of God. And I would say to you, you better listen. I don't think you better listen to my stories and all the stuff upon which I will build what I want to say to you, but perhaps there'll be a little heartstring might be plucked or a little note might be struck through what I say today that might really be meaningful to you. That's what I ask you to listen to. It's serious stuff. Who are the men of St. Alfred's Church in Blackburn, Victoria, Australia? Just a bunch of ordinary people? No way. You're a bunch of extraordinary people, for the God of creation, the master of eternity, has chosen to instill his very spirit within you. And so it's serious stuff for her to be here today. All that is introduction. What lessons can I tell you I've ever learned from life? I had in mind to tell you three nice little stories that I've written into a book and that I've spoken, told many times about faith, hope, and love. But I've changed that. And I'll tell you the first story just so to give you an idea of the life that I had when I was young. You have Andrew Little, who's supported from this church and a part of this church. He knows exactly what I'm talking about. And because that's been his life for so many years. But I remember the time when he has been living in the southern part of Papua New Guinea. I lived in the same place, operated for the same people in the same area. And I remember the day when I had in my, it was a Cessna 185, not a very fancy aeroplane, but a very proficient thing, to fly over to right over the top of the country to have my plane had some special maintenance that it needed, and I needed to fly a long way. And so we never flew empty. We always had loads on everywhere. You have to use this machinery correctly. And so I had a load of stuff that I had to drop into a mission station halfway, right smack in the middle of the mountains of Papua New Guinea. And for those of you who've been there, you know they are some mountains. And a very, very demanding aviation environment. It was a lousy day. And I remember I flew above the clouds and I found a little hole and I went down there and I landed and I had every intention of dropping off my cargo and going up through the same blue patch that I could see and getting above it all and flying on the extra couple of hours to where I was going. But the mission people for whom I was flying, they said, look, we're very urgently in need of you taking four guys up to the hospital at Mendi. Can you do that? I said, no, I can't. The weather's terrible and I don't think I could do that. And then they said, well, we won't be able to get them there for a couple of weeks. They are ambulatory people. They're not on, there's no stretcher involved, but they are not well, and we need them taken to some better care. So I said, okay, well, all right, let's put them on and I'll see if I can get there. I put these three fellas on. They were just savage people, and there was no education there, different sort of education. They had very little on, and they were just traditional mountain warriors. And they sat up on the seat, and I said, no, put your seat. I had to get their legs and put their legs down and their feet on the floor and strap them in. They'd never been in an aeroplane before, three in the back and one in the front beside me. And so we took off down that mountain airstrip, very steep, and across it. Can I get into the next valley? And there's rain everywhere, and I could see just a little gap, maybe 50, 100 feet between the cloud and the mountain top. And I snuck through there into the next valley, and then into the next one. And I'm running up to the northwest along a river, and it didn't take me long to realize that it was a stupid decision to take those men. It was not a good condition, and I wouldn't say I was frightened, but I tell you, I was working hard and thinking hard, trying to work out how I was going to negotiate this bad weather, this pouring rain and the mountains. I was in the valley in a canyon with the mountains about as far away as that wall, and on that wall on the other side with a white river running down through the middle, and I was flying along, and the plane was bouncing around. I paid no attention to anything but flying that aeroplane until I heard a noise from the back. And I heard this moaning noise, and I looked around the back, and there's these three black woolly heads all locked together, and these guys weren't frightened, they were petrified. And it was terrifying for them. And I thought, oh man, I'm supposed to be looking after these guys. And just look at this. And I looked at the guy sitting beside me, and he's sitting there and he's hanging onto to the strap on the wall of the airplane, and he's just looking around. And I thought, goodness. So I said to him in pidgin, hey, you know, got Fred? Aren't you afraid? And this is what he said. He said, Sikin blo mita soli Fred. Only my skin is afraid. Hang on. And I'm trying to keep away from the mountains and negotiate my way and trying to work out, what the heck does he mean? And I said, skin tassel. Yes, skin tassel, holy friend. Only my skin is afraid, and so that I need to find out more about this. I said, what about the rest of you? What about inside your skin? And he said, in the language that we could both use, he said, inside my skin, I am not afraid. I said, why aren't you afraid inside your skin? Because I know the one who made those mountains flying by. I know the one who created the cloud and who ordered the weather for the day. I look at the rocks flying by, and I know the one who made those rocks. And he lives in me, and he told me, fear not, for I am with you. I was absolutely staggered, and I'd done theological training, I'd done all sorts of stuff. I'd never heard a lesson on faith like that, a faith that worked, that it was only as far as his skin that the fearsome things of life would in any way proceed. How's your faith? How real is your faith? What is there about life that would frighten you? About money, about the future, about your kids, about relationships, about all sorts of things. And I looked at this guy and I saw his face, his body language, everything about him spelled out the very truth that he was not afraid. Fear not, for I am with you, God has said. Be not afraid, for I am your God. And I think, man, how authentic is my faith? How much can people see in my language, hear in my language, see in my body? See in my very expression, hanging on, looking outside. I knew he wasn't afraid. How real is our faith? How much do the men of St. Alfred's Church in Blackburn demonstrate to the world that flashes by, with whom you shop, with whom you work? How do you, as the people of God, reflect the very reality of all that your faith and that your relationship with God brings to you? So that's my first story, and that will do. I want to tell you about something else, and I'm going to change. I'm not going to tell you my hope story or my love story. Maybe I'll come back in a few years and tell you some other stories that I think also have value. But lessons from life. That was one lesson from life that I learned. I want to tell you about another lesson of life. And I changed my intention because of this political exercise that we've just gone through. Was anybody sick of all that stuff by the time last Saturday came? I hardly wanted to watch the television or listen to the radio for all that nonsense that was going on there. We've just come to a campaign. It wasn't very pretty. Thank God for Scott Morrison. At least, and in all of my life, I can't recall any other Prime Minister of this country that is prepared to say he believes in God and his faith and salvation is in Christ. Thank God for him. I hope you pray for him. But what a mess it is. The whole business of leadership. The whole business of these people control our lives. And what do we see? What is there about leadership? We talk about our Australian culture. We say, oh man, we're all about mateship. What a lot of rubbish. Have you watched Question Time recently? I don't see a great deal of mateship in Question Time. I see plenty of hatred, and I see plenty of arguments, and plenty of all sorts of nasty stuff. But what is it about leaders that we see around about us that really we can't handle? I remember when I was living in the United States in Southern California years and years and years ago, my son, who was a hippie, and he hadn't come back, he hadn't finished school, he finally came back at 27, finished school, went to law school, and now he's been a lawyer for the last 30 years dealing in Aboriginal affairs, and he's still there today, thank God. But he was thinking as an absolute hippie. He said, we're coming to the States, he and his live-in girlfriend, all those things that I questioned, and we want to come and see Sarah's parents in Canada. Can you come up and see us? And I said, no, we can't, Michael. This is our home here in the US. We'll pay your fare, that's not a problem. Come and see us. We don't want to come to the US. We don't like it. And most hippie people don't like the US, and lots of others don't like it also. But they finally agreed to come for 6 days, and they stayed for 6 months. And I tried to tell him about the personal profile of the American person. That they are hardworking, they are generous, they are hospitable, they love, they know how to recreate. And I drew this picture that he couldn't handle. And so we're walking one night around our town, and he said, can I say something to you, Dad? And I said, well, you've never held anything back until now. And he looked at me with this strange look on his face, and he said, I could live here, you know. I said, you dirty dog, all the things you've said about this country. Then he made a profound statement. He's a very intelligent guy. He said, Dad, everything you say that you've said about it is right. But that personality profile is not reflected in its government. And that personality is not reflected in its people, in its leadership generally. And he was right, of course. I said, what country does? What about Australia? What about corporate business? What about Bill Shorten's big end of town? What happens when people are given leadership responsibilities? And so I want to spend the rest of my time here. I can talk for hours on this, but I can't. But what does it mean? How does God want God's people to be led? And I remember in 1965, I was flying aeroplanes at a place called Wappanamunda in the middle of the highlands of Papua New Guinea. And my boss from Melbourne, he flew up and he overnighted with us. He doesn't usually do that, but he did on this occasion. He said, I've come here to be with you to tell you something. Because our board is concerned that the whole of the leadership of MAF is in my hands only. And I can't live forever, ever. And so they are suggesting, and I'm suggesting to them, that we want to talk to you about leadership. And he said, I'm not offering you my job, and I'm not offering a future role, but we just think that you ought to think about leadership and think about what it means to be a leader of men and women in this day and age. That was an amazing day for me. It set me off on a quest that goes on till this very day. What happens? And you know the old adage, power corrupts, absolute power corrupts absolutely. What happens to people when they get into a leadership role? And so the greatest lesson I've learned from life that I've had to put into my present and future life and speak to and work in is the lesson of leadership. What does it mean? And you say, hey, we're not leaders, we're just people of St. Alf's. You're all leaders. Every single one of you has leadership responsibility, and the same principles apply. You can go and get an MBA anywhere. Any university will offer you a management degree. Where do you learn to be a leader? So I could talk a lot, but I'll tell you just one thing. I'll talk about the political scene. A good friend of mine, one of my mentors, he was living in Sydney at the time, he called me from Sydney, and I was heading up MAF here at their Box Hill office, and in charge of work from Bangladesh and parts of Indonesia and Papua New Guinea and within Australia and the Solomon Islands, and I was struggling with my own leadership, and he called me and he said, I'm going to fly down to Sydney to see you tomorrow. I said, what on earth for? He said, because I'm going to tell you something that will change your life. I said, Gil, why didn't you just tell me on the telephone, save yourself the fare? And he said, no, I have to tell you. So he came down and he told me something that changed my life. I said, what is it you want to tell me? He said, I want to tell you this. My research department has just given me the final result of a lot of work that every prime minister and every cabinet member in every Pacific nation, every, was educated in mission schools. I said, that's an incredible statistic. So they're all educated by missionary teachers. Yes, all, not the French. He said, apart from the French in New Caledonia and so forth, but everybody else. I said, well, that's an amazing statistic. What does that mean? How's it going to change my life? Because you and I are going to go around and meet them all. And I said, you're only saying that because I have aeroplanes available to me. And he said, no, because I know you struggle in your leadership. And so that started me on a very, very interesting program. And we went around for the next 5-6 years. We created contacts with every CEO, every prime minister, every cabinet member of every Pacific nation, and found them struggling. But because of the education, we could draw them back to the world's greatest textbook on leadership, which is the Word of God. And we saw amazing things. And we used to take a plane and go from Papua New Guinea to the Solomon Islands, to Vanuatu, to Fiji, to Tonga, to Niue, to the two Samoas, to Tuvalu, Kiribati, Nauru, and back, and go and do a whole circuit of the South Pacific and spend a couple of days in each one in absolute privacy with no publicity whatsoever. Then later on, we went to Micronesia, started off at Majuro, and then Kosrae, Truk, and Saipan, and Guam, and all of those other places along the northern stretch of islands. And we saw the amazing need and the fact that the Word of God can meet the needs of leadership in this day and age in the political realm. And I have seen things happen. There were very strict rules. Nobody was to know about this. It was never to be publicized. Nobody was to bring any aides to any of our meeting. Just you and only you. No formality. All first names. And so we did the circuit of the whole Pacific. Then we'd invite them down to retreats and spend nothing else than hour after hour. Sometimes we'd pray halfway through the night for people crying over their ineptitude and their inability to lead people correctly. And we saw the Pacific change. What were the most things that made them cry? How do I be a leader and a husband? How do I be a leader and a father? Sir Peter Kenny-Laurier, who was the founding Prime Minister of the Solomon Islands, was at the very centre of our little group. And he would come with us. And I remember the night he said, he talked about his leadership in the Solomon Islands and how he was knighted by the Queen and how he's the first Prime Minister of that country for the first 10 years of its independence. And then he had to go into coalition with another party to retain that leadership role. And he said that after a year or two, things weren't too well between the coalition partners. And then there was a vote of no confidence. And the partnership fell to pieces. His prime ministership fell to pieces. He was no longer the prime minister. And he said it was just dreadful. And everyone around the room, the Prime Minister of Tonga and all of those countries were there, and I could just see that their hearts were bleeding for him. And he said, so I said to the Speaker of the House, please close this down early. I don't want my wife and kids to hear about this on the radio. And so he went home, went down to the school, got his kids, sat them around the table. And he said, kids, I have to tell you that every day of your life has been privileged. You've been the children of the Prime Minister of this country. That is no longer so. And I spoke to them about my terrible sense of loss. And he says, it was a very emotional time. And he said, and two of his kids, two eldest kids, a boy and a girl, got up and they walked around the table to him and they put their arms around him and said, Dad, we've been praying for this for 2 years. And then they said, listen to this, we'd rather have a daddy in this house than a prime minister. How do you lead? How do you lead in terms of the true values of life? And so all of this leadership stuff that was happening in my life, my own ineptitude, was tremendously impacted by what I saw happening in the Pacific. Years later, I was at a United Nations meeting in Geneva. We were arguing about Angola, believe it or not. And one fellow said to me from the UN, he said, you've got an Australian accent. And he looked at my card and said, yes, I lead an American organization. I was there from the United States, but I am Australian. He said, have you had any experience in the Pacific? I said, only 25 years of my life. And he said, well, something's happened in the Pacific that we don't understand. I head up the desk for the Pacific Forum. And if those of you who know, that's the entity that distributes all global aid in the Pacific. He said, and something's happened out there. He said, in the last few years, they've changed. Previously, they would fight and snarl and argue with each other and try and grab the influence for anything they could get. Now they don't. They say, hey, they do need this more than we do. They need those millions for new hospitals more than we do. We could do with this, but they, he said, it's just a totally different organization. And I said to this United Nations leader, I said, have you got 15 minutes and I'll tell you what happened? And I told him what happened, and he was absolutely blown away because, friends, the leadership principles of God work. And they work in the political realm. They work in the business realm. They work in the organizational realm. They work in the church realm. And they work in our families. What are they? Jesus said, the rulers of the Gentiles exercise authority over them and lord it over them. Not so with you. That's not my leadership style. I come amongst you as one who serves. And the whole business of servant leadership, it's all about the people. Can you see that in question time in Australia? Not really. I can't. Every now and again, I'll be very personal, I hope this is not being given to any radio station, but I remember being back in Australia when Mark Latham became the leader of the opposition. And I thought, I didn't know him, and I thought, oh, he's a smart young fellow, he's very voluble and he's going to change things, maybe it'll be a good thing for him to do. I stayed home and watched his maiden speech in Canberra, and I thought, I'll give you 6 months, mate, 6 months. He talked about leadership and he used the analogy of climbing a ladder. He used his hands, climbing a ladder. And you and I well know that the sort of leadership that we see that we don't like and don't know how to change, you climb the ladder with two hands and one foot because you've got to keep one foot free to kick the guy who's coming behind you. And if I'd had a chance to talk to him, I would have said, hey, Use your ladder allegory, that's fine. But it's a broad ladder. And you stay on the ground and you say, come on, guys, up you go. There's stuff for you to do. When the last one gets on the first ladder, you get on that. On the first step, you get on that step. And then you usher them up. It's all about the people. You remember the dummies books? Microsoft for Dummies, Windows for Dummies. I'd love to write a book on leadership for dummies. It wouldn't be a very long book. It'd only have 7 or 8 words in it. And what my leadership book for dummies would say, it's all about the people, dummy. Not about you. So I had to learn, how did that affect my leadership? I saw it work in the political realm. I remember crying and praying with people well into the night. I remember once we're going from Majuro. Kosrae was the first stop, a little tiny island between there and the other Micronesian islands. And I had tried the diplomatic approval and couldn't get approval to get there. But I finally made it and we landed there. They knew we were coming but hadn't responded. And the governor of the place came out and he met us. And he said, I don't know who you are. And Sir Peter Kenny-Laurier, the Prime Minister of the Solomon Islands, he was our spokesman. And he said, my name's Peter. Years ago, sailors and captains in their ships came from Spain and Portugal and England and America, sailed across our ocean, went home and drew lines all over it and separated us forever. And we've never been together again, but we are people of the Pacific. And we have come today to renew a relationship in the Creator God who made us. Man, you talk about welcome. We sat there for no more than 36 hours. We were off again. And when we left, I'll never forget what he said. We were standing under the wing of our aeroplane. And he said, Peter, he didn't call him Sir Peter, Peter, when I recognize who you are, where you've come from, and why you've come, I have to say to you that this is the most honorable visit this little island has ever had. What do you do about leadership of your home, of your church, of your people? What about where it absolutely conflicts with culture? I spent most of my leadership, after I got out of MAF, I worked in leadership development with another organization called Development Associates International, and I worked mainly in Russia. I mean, those guys had 75 years of communism following 1,000 years of czars. What do they know about leadership? It is just absolutely pathetic. I wish I could ask my friend Vladimir Osipov to come and tell you about his leadership in Russia. He became a follower of Jesus when the walls fell over, and he became a member of a church, an evangelical church, had about 9 or 10 churches and drug rehabilitation. It was a fantastic place. And they said to him, we want you to be the leader. He'd been an admiral in the Russian Navy, a captain of a nuclear submarine. And he said, no, I'm just a baby in Christ. I can't lead this. And they said, we're all babies in Christ. And so he reluctantly decided to be the leader of this church. And he said, and so I did it in the only way possible. The first thing I did was to get rid of my friends and to tell them they weren't needed, to take the office out of the office of the building. And he went on in the Russian way to say how he began to lead these people. You can't have the people alongside you. You've got to be in another building, away where you can issue edicts. And he got more and more emotional as he was talking to me. And he said, and Max, I just am seeing my organization fall to pieces. I don't know how God wants his people to be led. I remember once I was taking a workshop in Krasnodar in Russia, And there were, it was the leadership of the non-Orthodox church in Russia, about 30 of them. They all had PhDs in theology, brilliant guys. And I thought, who am I to be running this? And so I did the first day on Nehemiah. If you don't know it, it's probably the best Old Testament book on leadership you'd ever find. And have a look at the patterns he used in how to do his job. And then the second day was my Russian colleague doing it, and he, of course, got onto Jesus. And I could sense on the second day they were totally engaged on my day. When my friend Vadim started to work on the New Testament, they couldn't handle it. And he talked about shepherding. I give my life for the sheep. The words of Jesus, history's greatest leader. And the whole concept of shepherding, of serving, I come amongst you as one who serves, of the empowerment of the people. I send you out and trust you with my work, Jesus said. And I could see that they were disengaging. And I thought, what's going on here? And one of them got up. He was the archbishop of a whole bunch of churches from Sebastopol in Ukraine. And he said, let's stop here. I want to make a statement. And I want to make it in English so that Max, I was sitting up the back with an interpreter guy, so that Max can understand. He said, Max, yesterday it was wonderful. And all I had done was ask them to look at Nehemiah and then Saul, David, and Solomon and ask about the things that they could identify, and they knew them all. Identify the things that God frowned on and the things that God smiled on, and see if you can draw up a pattern of what was acceptable to God in lives of those three kings. And then but when we got on to Jesus, they changed. Yesterday was wonderful, he said, but today we're finding it very difficult. And Vadim, and you are telling us about servanthood. You are telling us about shepherding. You are telling us about empowering. And he said, Max, you have to understand. And he shook his finger at me. This is Russia. That will not work here. And so culture sometimes takes over. Doesn't it take over in our Australian situation? And so I said to them, why don't we just stop right now? Put all your material away, and for the next 12 hours, you teach me about Russian culture. What is it in your history? What is it that makes you the sort of people that you are that absolutely conflicts with the gospel of Jesus Christ, whom you proclaim? It ended up being the best workshop I think I've ever been to. It was fantastic. And so we go on, and the whole business of leadership, and I only tell you this as a lesson from life. I can tell you about faith and hope and love, but I want to come from this other direction and teach you to look, or to challenge you to look into the Word of God to know how people should be led, and to examine the leadership things of the world, to examine the leadership things within your own home and marriage and family, and see whether you are reflecting the things of God. And that's all I have enough time for. I could talk to you for hours, but that's enough. Who are you? When you go home and your wife says, oh, how was it this morning? Oh, it was okay. Oh, it was good. It was really good. What are you hearing? What are you hearing? I remember, and I'll just tell you one little story. I remember talking to a political leader here in Blackburn, Australia. He was from the Liberal Party. He wasn't a politician. He was a mover and a shaker in the political world. And I said, how do you take the leadership style of Jesus into the political world in Australia? He said, what? I said, you're a member of a church, you're an elder in a church, you teach a Sunday school, you are a person who follows Christ. How do you take that leadership into the Australian political society? And he didn't want to answer, and he said, well, the simple answer is, Max, I don't. Yes, I am those things you say. I get into the political world, and these were his words. And I roll up my sleeves and I get my hands as bloodied as anyone else. Living in a totally different compartment between his work and his faith. How about you? How are the lessons of life that you are picking up impacting the way you live and the way you are, the way you speak and the way you act? Are you hearing anything from God today? My stories mean nothing. It's the essence. It's the essence of what's in there that maybe there are things that we need to be more attuned to. In terms of our criticisms around, how can we answer? What are you, just the men of an Anglican church in Melbourne? You could change this nation. You could change this world and have be an impact for change, because you are the men of the Creator. And with God, all things are possible, and He trusts you with the lessons you learn from life. Thank you.
So, thanks, Max. It's a fantastic message, and I know you're bursting to say more things.
Yep.
And you've got about 5 minutes, so I know a couple of guys will have questions. There's a couple of, squeeze a couple of quick ones in, and I'll run around the microphone to whoever wants to ask a question. So anyone, jump out now, and I'm sure Max is all too keen to respond. Any questions? Mark.
Have you written a book about your exploits with MAF, particularly in New Guinea and the Pacific?
Yes, I have. I've written two books. And they have... well, that was years and years and years ago. I left MAF in 1998, and I've been working... I was only 63. I wasn't young enough to retire, and I don't like retirement, so I worked another 12 years with this leadership ministry that I was telling you about. But I have written two books. I don't think they're any longer in print, but you can get a combination of those two books, and it's called Eyes Turned Skyward. You can get it off the MAF webpage as an e-book.
Thank you, because when you're saying it, they're old... Information is not old. The world doesn't change that much in people.
Thank you.
Any other takers? Yes, Mark. Thank
you. Max, thanks very much for your presentation. When we live in the world, and in some highly combative parts of the world, like you've used politics as an example, there are others, you're often in a tribal fight with other people, and they're after you, and their view of the world is, I'm going up a ladder and I'm using at least 1 foot, maybe two, to kick you down.
Sure.
So there's a certain amount of defence or protection that you need to put in just to keep yourself there and maybe look after your people as well. So there is an element of fighting and combat that needs to go on in terms of that. How do you put that together with the model of leadership? So the model of leadership is, yes, I'm going to look after my people, I might serve my people, I might die for my people, but at the same time I'm also trying to protect them and their interests, and I am in, depending on the context, I might be in combat with people who'd like to take me and my people down. How do you put those two things together?
I wish we had another half hour. You could teach me how to do that. But the point is, it can be done. Going back to my Australian politician, my political friend, and I said to him, do you think there's any possibility that God gave you your interest in Australian politics and your involvement so that you would take him into that? You know what his response was? I don't want to be crucified, Max. And so there is a risk involved. I'm very religious. I'm a devout coward. I don't want to be I don't want to be crucified either. But, and I'm not saying this like any sort of a hero, I have to be prepared to be, and I might say so to you. So what is the cost of our faith? And is there any cost to it? I mean, you go to the football, I go to this, and you go to that. Oh, you go to church. Yeah, oh, fair enough. What does it mean? And how real is your faith if you are the people of God? You don't want to be crucified. He asked his son to be crucified. And he turned his back on his son so that you and I could know salvation. And so there is a risk, there is a danger. But there's nothing wrong with ambition. But it's a matter of how the ambition is centered and being open for change. My ambition told me when I was young I'd be flying aeroplanes all my life. I haven't flown an aeroplane since I was 38 years old. And yet that time in my life has been utilized to build me into the sort of person that I am today. And in his grace, he moves us incrementally from one thing to another. And sometimes life is tough. And someone once told me, who was one of my mentors, the great little words of advice he used to give to me. And he said to me this time, when I was having incredible trouble, and you couldn't half guess that my trouble were with people, that's where the leadership problems are, dealing with people. And he said, Max, just remember also, you can't move onwards and upwards when you're bending over backwards. And I thought, man. So sometimes you've got to stand up straight in the certainty of your relationship with God and move ahead. But then he said, you know that if you do stand up, somebody's going to fall off and get hurt. That's tough to deal with. And so leadership is not an easy gig, believe you me. But a very good question. Is ambition wrong? No. But I remember the day I got the clear message from God, I gave you that ambition to fly when you were a kid. And the whole business of the will of God, what is the will of God? Oh man, I thought it was like a great big slot car game, and God had my slot all predestined and all perfectly worked out. If I fell out of it, he'd put me back in. I don't believe that anymore. I believe that to a certain extent, the will of God is sanctified common sense, enwrapped in an absolute conviction to Christ. I will go anywhere, be anything that you want me to be, but I know you're going to leave those decisions up to me, so please give me wisdom. In all my leadership years, I never prayed for success, but every single day I prayed for wisdom. Does that make me wise? Not necessarily, but he is.